tonight, let's go back for just a minute as we do a very quick review and look first at chapter 16, as a matter of fact, verses 5 and 6. I heard the angel of the waters saying, righteous are you who are and who was, O Holy One, because you judge these things. For, verse 6, they poured out the blood of saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink. They deserve it. Then you come into chapter 17, which we studied last week, and we have at verse 1, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, and with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication, and carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, and having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her fornication. And upon her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. So, back in chapter 16, the grounds for the judgment that's being discussed is the blood of the saints. And those that are guilty of that blood deserve it. In chapter 17, when we get a much more full picture of this monstrous beast and the woman that is riding it, we have exactly the same designation for her eventual destruction. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. It's really very specific. We talked last week about that word witnesses. We looked in the book of Acts how that's very specifically limited there to the apostles. This is the grounds for the judgment. This woman is guilty of that blood. Now, of course, we're trying to sort out who is this Babylon. What is that about? It is a mystery city. It has many different designations in both chapter 17 and in chapter 18. And this is the great theme. Who's responsible for the blood of the saints? Now, I gave you two passages in the Gospel of Luke that will help us outside the book of Revelation, still yet to identify this woman. Do you remember, does anybody have written down, what were the two passages in the book of Luke? One of which Donna gave me the week after I had taught the class, and one that I gave you, so we've looked at it 2 weeks now, this will be the third week. What are those two passages in Luke that you should have written over in Revelation 16 at verse 6 and 17 verse 6? Maybe again you should have it in chapter 18 at verse 20. Let's read that now. Rejoice over her, O heaven, you saints and apostles and prophets, because God's pronounced judgment for you against her. Or maybe you wrote it down there in the last verse of chapter 18. In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth. Or maybe you wrote those verse references in chapter 19 at verses 1 and 2. In the middle of verse 1, hallelujah, salvation and glory and power belong to our God, because his judgments are true and righteous, for he has judged the great harlot who was corrupting the earth with her fornication, and he has avenged the blood of his bondservants on her. What were those two chapters in Luke? I mean, there they are. Luke 11, 49 through 51, and Luke 13, I forget now, verses 33 to 35. Got it written in the margin of my Bible, so there it is. Those two passages will designate Jerusalem as being the city guilty of the blood of the apostles and prophets. And especially in Luke 13, Jesus says that it can't be any other. And so outside the book of Revelation, when we're trying to interpret the symbols of Revelation, you know, we have clues, much like we've seen in the Old Testament already, imagery that is used in the Old Testament, or statements that are made by Jesus, or other statements made by the apostles in other parts of the New Testament, help us in understanding the book of Revelation. So I suggested that that's who we're talking about. This city, this mystery Babylon, has to do with Jerusalem. Now, in chapter 17, though, of course, we have a great deal of information, particularly in verses 7 to the end of the chapter, that deal with the beast as well. There's a beast that carries her with seven heads and ten horns in verse 7. In verse 8, it was and is not and is about to come. That's said twice in verse 8. In verse 11, it's said again, the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth and one of the seven. So we've got these seven kings, these seven heads that we're trying to identify. And then, skipping down to verse 16, the ten horns which you saw, the beast, will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. So we have these various component parts of this beast, which all seem to go to the fact that the heads represent, the beast represents, the Roman Empire, which is pretty commonly agreed among all of the members of the Lord's Church, at least, that's the Roman Empire. The woman, I think, is different. The woman has demonstrated a relationship with, and yet also she's riding upon, she has some control or influence over, the Roman Empire. I suggested a number of ways that that might be. You'll find those in your syllabus notes, not the least of which is that unlike most of the countries that Rome was dominating, the Jews had been given the right to retain much of their secular government as well as their religious administration as well. They still had their temple, they still had their sacrifices, they still had their high priest, they still had all that going on. It had not been denied them. And so she has influence over the Roman Empire, and particularly within the boundaries of Israel itself. So that, I think, is the land that's being discussed here at such great length. Then last week, using primarily chapter 17, but also some of chapter 18, we went through many, but not all, of the identifying characteristics of this woman. So we have a list of descriptions, and then we ask ourselves, do they fit Rome or do they fit Jerusalem when we're talking about the woman riding the beast as opposed to the beast, seeing that the beast is going to kill the woman, burn her with fire, is going to destroy her. We went through this list last week, so I'm not going to do it again. You will have in your notes, I guess I should get my own open, so get it referenced right there, but on page 54 in your syllabus, and if you have the smaller version, it would be the page in between chapter 17 and chapter 19. You'll have a chart there that lists these same characteristics. And then we're asking ourselves, which fits better, Rome or Jerusalem, seeing that once again, and certainly among saints at least, really the only two possibilities are Rome and Jerusalem. Among the Lord's people, they have enough familiarity with the Bible to recognize, immediately that we're not talking about China, we're not talking about the United States, we're not talking about the European Union, we're not talking about all silliness that's been suggested by those who promote an eschatological system called premillennialism. You're familiar with that term here, I'm sure everyone. So the idea that Revelation was not fulfilled shortly or soon is held by most people in America today, and they think, therefore, that all these things haven't happened yet. And they're looking for it to be Russia or who knows what all else that is something contemporary with us. Not so. Among the Lord's people, we recognize there's only two biblical or historical possibilities that could even begin to meet the stipulated requirements in Revelation that these events are soon or shortly or quickly to come to pass. It's either Rome or it's Jerusalem. It's just all that you have to pick between. We saw, for instance, though, that with regard to this first descriptor, Revelation 14:8, 17:2, and 18:3, that the nations are fornicating with her, which likely represents religion and politics and trade and knows what all else. It fits Rome fine. Rome could meet that description without too much trouble. But as we look at the rest of these descriptive terms, Rome won't work for the reasons that I put in the center column of your chart. She just can't fit. And since she doesn't fit any but one of these various descriptors. You know, Rome is ruled out. Jerusalem, on the other hand, is going to fit absolutely every one of these. So when you've got one of these phrases that fits just fine, you know, for Rome, but all of them that fit for Jerusalem, in my mind, it's really sealed. That it's Jerusalem that we're talking about in chapter 17 and 18. And we're going to continue then to look at what chapter 18 tells us about this woman and her fall or failure as we continue here tonight. Bill, you had a comment or question?
Yeah, I had a question. 17:11 at the end of the verse.
I'm sorry, where? 17:11, everybody. The beast which was and is not.
And what is this provision?
I have, and goes to destruction in 17:11 in the New American Standard. Bill had the word perdition in his translation. He's asking what that is. What I suggested last week with regard to that is that there's two ways to understand the Greek phrase. And it can mean, and you'll see it in some translations, the way they translate it suggests that it is the beast that is going to be destroyed or will suffer this perdition, whatever that is. Another way to translate that or to understand the translation is that it is the one that goes to do that destroying. It is the one which creates that havoc. And I prefer that latter translation and understanding. So that it is Rome, since it's described clearly in the chapter as hating the woman and going to destroy the woman and gathers other kings together to be involved in that destruction, that it is going to that destruction, is going to do, perform, you know, wreak that havoc upon the woman. So that's my understanding of it, is that they will be the ones that perform this destruction upon her. Okay? All right, now, let's go on then into chapter 18, and again, as always, I think it's wise for us to get all of it in our minds as we're looking at the continuing picture here. So I'm going to read it all. This is the New American Standard, Revelation chapter 18. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become a dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her fornication. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." Now, let's just pause for a brief aside. I do this frequently, and I haven't mentioned it in probably months, and so it's probably helpful if I do again tonight. You may be noticing, if you're reading the New American Standard, I declare that I'm going to read the New American Standard. You're looking then for the word fornication several times in these first verses, and if you're reading the New American Standard, you never saw it. You saw instead the word immorality. Remember, again, in the New American Standard, I think they do a particularly poor job with that word. Its root is porneia. It is exclusively sexual in its inherent nature. So if you just translate it immorality, that's too loose, it's too general, it doesn't get to the sexual nature of it. So I will, on the fly, retranslate, you know, for the New American Standard, and I use the word fornication. So you'll see that occasionally. My apologies if that throws you off, but I do that very purposely because immorality is just not what the word means. It means sexual immorality. Yes?
We don't have any chapter 18 in our workbook. Is that by design?
It is, and thanks for pointing it out. Greg pointed it out to me in an email this week, too. Appreciate Greg all the way through here. Occasionally sends me material. It's really helpful and thoughtful, and he caught the same thing this last week. Wanted to make sure that I hadn't lost the page there. No, the chapter 18 and 17 I just conflated really and put into that chart that you have on the page that would have been chapter 18. And so that was by design. It was intentional. Thank you, though, for catching that. Okay, so now we have all this fornication going on in the first three verses. Let's turn to verse 4 now in Revelation 18. I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back, even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, 'I sit as a queen, and I am not a widow, and will never see mourning.' For this reason, in one day, her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she'll be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. And the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, 'Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for in one hour your judgment has come.' And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her, because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every citron wood and every article of ivory and every article from costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. And the fruit you long for has gone from you. And all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, 'Woe, woe, the great city! She was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in one hour such great wealth has been laid waste. And every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor and as many as make their living by the sea stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What city is like the great city?' And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, 'Woe, woe, the great city, in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in one hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her.' And a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'Thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. The sound of harpists and musicians and flute players and trumpeters will not be heard in you any longer, and no craftsman of any craft will be found in you any longer. The sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer, and the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer. The voice of the bridegroom and bride will not be heard in you any longer, for your merchants were the great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery, and in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth.'" After these things, in chapter 19 now, "I heard as it were a loud voice of a great multitude in heaven saying, 'Hallelujah, salvation and glory and power belong to our God, because his judgments are true and righteous, for he has judged the great harlot who was corrupting the earth with her fornication, and he has avenged the blood of his bondservants on her.' And a second time they said, 'Hallelujah, her smoke rises up forever and ever.'" So, thus she comes to an end. who is she? Okay. Well, again, you know, I have the chart on the board. I have the chart, you know, in your notes. Brethren, think on these things. Study these things. There's only two possibilities. Now, in chapter 18, I suppose you'll find the strongest argument in favor of Rome. And again, I'll freely grant, while on my chart, you know, I suggest that really nothing on the chart is going to fit Rome except that first one. There's a very viable, reasonable, you know, strong argument for Rome when you're looking at all these commodities and you're looking at all these people that are weeping and lamenting and you're thinking about, you know, the sea traders and all of that. It is very easy and very possible to think, you know, only Rome would be likely to be described in this manner. The question they're asking and the argument that's being made in favor of Rome is that it doesn't sound like that Jerusalem would have had that much mercantile influence, that Jerusalem would have been that prominent in the economy of the world at that time, or that Jerusalem would have had that much influence or interaction with what sounds like such a wide area, so that, you know, it sounds like the whole Roman Empire is going to be upset and just weeping, you know, horribly at the loss of the trade that's taking place with her. And so, brethren, for a lot of people, and I think rightly so, and I held the view myself in years gone by, when you look at chapter 18 more than 17, please note on the chart, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the 9 descriptive terms that I put into that chart are all out of chapter 17. And only got 2 at the bottom that really are flowing out of chapter 18, and only one real reference there, which is verses 4 through 8. And so, you know, maybe I've been unfair, but the chart, of course, wouldn't fit on the screen either. I'm not trying to be unfair, but I think the evidence is so much stronger for Jerusalem that, admittedly, I haven't, you know, on this chart at least, tipped the hat sufficiently, maybe, for the view of Rome. But in response to that, you know, let me say, Jerusalem, brethren, was pivotal to the Roman economy. And while certainly it's a smaller city, that's true, it, between the two, Rome's a bigger town, and it's the capital of the whole empire, where Jerusalem is certainly not that. You know, nonetheless, when you think about Jerusalem's place geographically, as well as its strategic location economically, I've been looking at this, you know, very closely since 1987. I've read more than one whole book that's trying to argue in favor of Rome, largely from this 18th chapter right here. And at least in my studies, you know, I'm satisfied that certainly Jerusalem can be described as it is in Revelation chapter 18, even though she doesn't have as many people living in her. I think we're all familiar with the fact, though, that all trade routes from the east, and all is too big a word, but very centrally, are coming to Jerusalem. This via Maris and others, you know, are King's Highways and whatnot, you know, just focusing on Jerusalem. Much of the trade that is coming from all these eastern countries is flowing, their caravans are coming into Jerusalem before they're headed on down into Caesarea, the major seaport, and thence off to Rome itself and all points surrounding the Mediterranean perimeter there. And all I'm trying to say is, brethren, you know, I really have looked at every one of those commodities. Looked at every one of the individuals that are mourning this loss. And for the life of me, I can't find any one of them that would not have been something that was being used, traded, or passing through on its way to being traded in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was certainly handling all these materials. Jerusalem was certainly one of the more prominent cities in the whole Roman Empire. And its loss was catastrophic to the trade of the Mediterranean Sea and the Roman Empire. You can't just destroy a city like this one, which is smaller than Rome, but still very sizable, very influential, and extremely wealthy. You can't just take one down like that and not have anybody notice. It was huge. And so just in general, bear that in mind. Certainly the Roman Empire is bigger, and it's the capital. But when you read this description, you would nonetheless be traumatized by the loss of this city economically to the Roman Empire. That's one of the major reasons Rome did not want to destroy this city. They didn't want the rebellion. They did not want to have to go in there. They done all they could, you know, to forestall and prevent it. Vespasian and Titus both begged the Jews not to force their hand. They gave orders not to see that temple destroyed. And it was only because the Jews were everything the Bible describes, so hard-hearted and intractable and rebellious and sinful, that they just absolutely, you know, were unyielding and forced the Romans to do what they did not want to do, because they loved that trade. They wanted that money. And it just rocked the world, brethren, when it went away. So now, let's go, though, and look more, you know, directly, individually at each of these verses. But largely, chapter 18 is dealing with this long list of commodities and all of this woe. So most of the descriptive terms for this woman, you know, are out of chapter 17 anyway. But in 18, as the vision begins, or this portion does, in verse 1, we have another angel coming down from heaven, great authority, the earth is illumined with his glory. So that's what John sees in the vision. He cries out with a mighty voice, and please note this, fallen is the universal translation. I don't think there's any translation that doesn't use that word. But it is at least of note that that's not the only way to translate this word. And in fact, again, I don't think it's really the best. Failed is what the word means. Failed. Failed is Babylon. That's an inherent part of this. Now, certainly fallen is an adequate and justifiable way to translate it, but if the only idea you get out of the word is that her walls crumbled and she was burned, you know, and it fell in the sense that it was destroyed, you're missing at least one very prominent aspect of the word by definition. What's inherent within this is that all this destruction and woe and burning and everything that's being described is because she failed. She hasn't lived up to her expectations. Failed. Failed is Babylon the Great. And she's become a dwelling place of demons, a prison of every unclean spirit. That word can be translated haunt of every unclean spirit, a haunt of every unclean and hateful bird. All the nations have drunk of the wine. And again, I'm just giving you actual definitions from the Greek. I'm not objecting to the word passion in verse 3, the passion of her immorality. But the word really is wrath, the wrath of her immorality, the wrath of her fornication. They are drunk with the wine of the wrath of her fornication. They're drunk with this wrathfulness that God is unleashing here too. In other words, they've been participating with her. They're drunk along with her. And the kings of the earth committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth become rich by the wealth of her fornication, or sensuality, rather. In verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive of her plagues. Now, brethren, that's an important verse. And I put it in the chart. People are to come out of her. There are two senses in which you can come out of something. To continue from the Corinthian letters, and be separate. Okay? One, you could do it as we have in our culture, We can come out and be separate spiritually, morally. We can remain in our houses and continue to conduct business and be Americans and still come out of her because we live a different kind of life by a different moral standard. Spiritually, we are distinct and separate. We're in her, but we're not of her, if you will. That's true, and I think that certainly that's fine within the verse. But brethren, then it says, also, there's two things in the verse, come out of her that you not receive of her plagues. Now the city's going to be destroyed, and the city's going to be burned. The city is hated, and the nations gather, and she's utterly destroyed. She has failed, and she'll fall then, you know, be destroyed. Was anybody ever taught in Scripture that they should come out of Rome so they would not suffer from her plagues, so they wouldn't be destroyed along with her? And the answer is no. But you know how all those weeks we spent in Matthew chapter 24, that is the whole point of Jesus teaching in numerous occasions, not just on the Mount of Olives in Matthew 24, that physically you should come out of her so that you can be saved when the city is destroyed. And I've learned this from another teacher. I passed it on to you. I wish I'd invented it myself. You know, I haven't. But it's not salvation from sin. What did I tell you? It's salvation of skin. Not salvation from sin, but salvation of skin that Jesus is talking about in Matthew 24. You come out of Jerusalem, you know, flee so you're not killed physically. So both of those aspects, I think, are present in this verse. It's chapter 18 and verse 4. But the second part of it, and that you may not receive of her plagues, brethren, is just not going to fit Rome in any way. But it fits Jerusalem as a first century, this generation, soon to come to pass, factual, physical, and historical reality. So I mean, it's an important thing to remember that when you've got some things that can fit Rome, and I suggested, this fornication, the first one, and then the lamentation in chapter 18, yeah, that can fit Rome, but the second part doesn't. Coming out of her that you not suffer her plagues only fits with Jerusalem. So in verse 5, because her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. What are her iniquities? What is she guilty of? Chapter 16, verses 5 and 6. Chapter 17, verse 6. Chapter 18, verse 20, and verse 24, and 19. Down in verse 2, what was it all about? Avenging the blood of the apostles and prophets. That's Jerusalem. She is the only city held responsible for those things. So, in 6 of chapter 18, she's getting paid back. She's getting paid back double. In the cup she mixed, brethren, what is in the cup that the woman is drinking? What is she drunk with in 17:6? The blood of the saints. Yes, Rome did some persecuting of the saints. Starting in 64 AD with Nero, when he blamed the Christians for the fire in Jerusalem. He may or may not have set himself. I don't know. I think probably not. He just capitalized on it, but who knows? Maybe he did set it on purpose. But brethren, saints had been persecuted for 30 years before that. Starting in what city? Jerusalem. And by whom? The Jews, who were going to be punished in that generation. So when we're looking down here in chapter 18 and verse 6, she's getting paid back double according to her deeds in the cup she mixed twice as much for her. What's in the cup? The blood of the saints. What's coming double back for her? Blood. Death and destruction. She's going to get it. Look at 7. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning, for she says in her heart, I sit as a queen and I'm not a widow and will never see mourning. What were the Jews arguing with Jesus? We are the children of Abraham. We are the chosen people of God. We are God's favored people. We cannot fail. And that's the song they sang in Jerusalem to the very bloody and bitter end. They truly believed that some Gideon would rise up with 300 and he would rescue them from the Romans. They were going to get over this because that's the way it had been in the Old Testament. And they were pretty wrong, weren't they? Horribly wrong. And that because they were so arrogant, so proud. I sit as a queen. I am not a widow. I will never see mourning. They couldn't believe it. Now, in 8, for this reason, in one day her plagues will come. Excuse me, hour. Well, it is day here. I'm sorry, verse 8. In one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine. In one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she'll be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. Now, brother, at this point, starting at verse 4, the voice is a part of the vision, but it's explaining the vision. So, fallen is Babylon the Great. There's a great angel with authority. The earth is illumined with his glory in the early verses. But now, starting in verse 4, there's explanation taking place. So, plagues, pestilence, mourning, famine, burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. These are the things that are coming upon the city, Mystery Babylon, drunk with the blood of the saints in her cup. Okay, these are the things. Does that fit Rome very well? And it truly does not. There's a reason why Gibbon wrote a book, several volumes, called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Why is the, by all accounts, the greatest history of Rome that has ever been written by Gibbons, G-I-B-B-O-N-S, and tough reading, by the way. I've only been through portions of it. By the time I got to the 300s, I quit. But that's the point. By the time I've read an awful lot of material in Gibbon's humongous masterwork, I give up by the time I get to the 300s A.D. Why? Because Rome is still going strong in the 300s A.D. 300s. 230 years after Revelation would have been written, Rome was still going fine and would be. Very interesting, brethren. Ask some historian sometime, when did Rome fall? And then, in what day? In what hour? And then watch the debate begin. Because it didn't fall like that. It slowly eroded and crumbled over centuries. It did not fall in one big catastrophic event. So they argue. Some for the 300s, some for 476 A.D., which is the one most people will go for. And they'll say, well, by 476 A.D., you can say for sure that Rome is no more. The empire really is just, no longer what it was. Brethren, my point is, it was the decline and fall. It was a very lengthy, drawn-out, slow process. It's not like a day or an hour and she's burned and destroyed. How did Jerusalem fall? Just like that. Yeah, it was 3.5 year siege. But after 3.5 years, very small time in history, literally in one day and in one hour, what happened to Jerusalem? Temple was burned. The city was lost. And the Romans went to work in what was not very long, a matter of only a few days and months, and they dismantled everything and tossed it off the edges of the Temple Mount, scattering those stones exactly like Jesus had said in the temple and many more, you know, too, and it was over. It just does not fit Rome. But something that was soon to come to pass when the book was written was the fall of Jerusalem. And when you read Josephus, and by the way, I don't think I've ever had a Bible student that has been a greater joy to me than Lee Carter. It's you. She pays attention when I say, do this, and then she does it. So she got a copy of Josephus. She started reading Wars of the Jews. But she went and got the common translation that everybody knows about, Whiston, from the 1700s. And she came to me here not long ago. You know, she'd read over half of it. I think, you know, she's like, it's just so hard to read. And I said, oh, you probably got Whiston's translation. You know, well, in the 1700s, what was English like? Real different than it is now. It's just so hard. I have to read the same sentence over and over again. But what I hear, I'm sorry, you know, take my copy, which was translated only like 15 years ago, modern day rabbi, and, you know, modern day English, you'll read this. And then she came back and she said, I started over. Started over? You've already read this massive amount. You started over? Yeah, now I can understand it. She's going back through it all. But what she's finding there, brethren, and what brings me such delight and pleasure, you know, is these things. So when you read about the fall of Jerusalem in the eyes of a first century Pharisee who had fought against Rome and watched all of this, he saw, and now let's go back and look at verse 8, he saw plagues, pestilence, mourning, famine, and fire, and he describes them all in very great detail, doesn't he, Lee? Sure does. See? But it doesn't fit Rome. Rome didn't go down like that. Long decline and eventual fall, not like Jerusalem, not like that verse. Right? Okay.
Are those more befitting of Jerusalem than Rome?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know. Maybe that's another column where we could say kind of fits Rome, if you will. What is a queen? A ruler. See, somebody who has gargantuan power. Well, Rome certainly had that. Then you have this phrase, I am not a widow. I'm not sure I know what to make out of that. The idea is, what is a widow? Happy or sad? Has she lost power, maintained power, or gained power? You've always lost power. If you lose a mate, you're weaker. See? It's a symbol somehow of losing something. Okay, and then what's the third one? I forget now. And we'll never see mourning. Okay? Well, again, I don't know that that would fit Rome quite as well, because true enough, you know, arrogant, powerful, there'd be many in Rome who thought that. But again, trying to give credit and be fair, in those about 18 months after Nero committed suicide and before Vespasian left off the attacks on Israel and came back to become king, in those 18 months, the whole Roman Empire was tottering, and they were fearful that the nation would fall completely. They had three guys tried to take over as king. None of them could get it done. They didn't have an emperor effectively in that period of time. And so you could argue, you know, that you say, I would never mourn. They were mourning, and they were fearful, and then Vespasian came and kind of relieved all of that. As far as seeing something distinct, compelling, or powerful that would go one way or the other, I really don't. I couldn't say, well, boy, that looks like Jerusalem and not Rome, or that looks like Rome and not Jerusalem. They're just, for me, they're just a little too general. Okay, I've got two hands. Saber, let's go first with you.
In my Bible, it's in quotes and in large print,
okay,
which would indicate it was a quote from another part of the Bible.
Yeah, Saber's pointed out that in the New American Standard, they will use all capitals to represent an Old Testament verse that's being quoted. And in this case, they're suggesting, and I have to look and see myself here, that that quote would be from Isaiah 47:7-8, as well as Zephaniah 2 and verse 15. But tonight I just confess I'm not up on that right now and I can't comment on it. I'm going to have to leave that to you. That's gone from me, you know, at the moment. But apparently it is a quote from the Old Testament, which very likely would suggest Jerusalem before it would Rome. But I can't comment on it right now. I just don't have an answer for you. Right, Carol, also.
The fact that she's called the queen, I guess she would be that way, but if you think about Jerusalem, they were a power unto themselves under the king, which would have been Rome. So in the situation, they would have not have been able to be the ruler of the country, but the second.
But they pushed Rome around a lot, and to the degree that they even got the Messiah killed, you know, that way. So I could see it working that way. But this is what I mean by nothing so distinctive that it, you know, answers the question for me. In Jerusalem, if it is Jerusalem, and she's saying, "I'm a queen," who's the king that Jerusalem or all Jews would think of as being married to them? God himself. See? So they wouldn't put themselves above him. They would say, "I'm the queen. I am married to God, who is the king." Okay? And then if it's Jerusalem, and we're thinking therefore about Jews, then what would their thinking be in saying, "And I'm not a widow. God is not dead to me. God's still married to God. I'm the queen, and he lives." See that?
There's quite a few references in the major prophets, I think, as well as the Old Testament, that the Jews felt no matter what sins they committed, as long as they had the temple, they were God's people.
That's absolutely correct. See, they couldn't imagine that they could lose this battle. They could not imagine that that temple could come down. And so it's exactly what Jesus was saying. What did he say? They would not know. You know, so there'll be two men in the field and two women grinding and all of that until the day comes. See, and they couldn't imagine. Okay? But again, I don't see anything decisive. So I have to tip my hat again to those who will say, "Well, I could see Rome in here." Well, I can too. I see it's arguable. I just don't see it as being as likely. And certainly not in the rest of the context. Okay, now, in the Don't Fear, as you look at, you know, the fact that the five-minute bell just rang, because what happens now in verse 9 and following? It's just all this weeping and lamentation. And I didn't intend to spend a lot of time on that. It's just a lengthy passage about how unhappy everybody is that Babylon fell. Kings of the earth, verse 9, committed fornication with her, lived sensuously with her. They weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning. And certainly they did. The Roman Empire was hard hit by the loss of so many people who were so wealthy and so strategically located. And now that city's gone. The trade routes are altered. Everything changes. And certainly they're not buying and selling in that town like they used to be. So, in verse 10, "Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, in 1 hour your judgment has come. The merchants of the earth weep, the cargoes are all listed, and we've read them once, I don't see any reason to list them again." Now, one of the things that Greg wrote me this week, and we talked about a little bit, you know, just by email, is that some have suggested that as you look at this list, and then they argue both ways, well, the list would only apply to Rome. No, the list is actually talking about the very commodities that were used in the Jewish sacrifice. And so, these are temple commodities, some will argue, and others will say, no, you know, they're Roman. And again, for me, it's just not conclusive. It's one of those things that go either way. And so, I pointed out to Greg as we were talking about it, for instance, ones that are particularly difficult for me is down at verse 13, "Horses and chariots and slaves and human lives." While those things are certainly being traded and passing through in various ways, Jerusalem, those things are not directly a part of temple worship. See, they're not commodities that were being used on the Temple Mount. directly, certainly. And so again, I just say, well, the city, yes, temple worship, no, and so I can't make a big argument in favor of Jerusalem tying it to the temple. I just say, generally, it would still be true of the city at large. Then, in verse 15, it's all the same thing. They're just weeping and mourning. Verse 16, woe to the great city, clothed in fine linen. Jerusalem was a magnificent, unbelievably magnificent city. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been laid waste. The cataclysm of her fall, the conflagration of her fall, you know, is an astonishing thing. And then shipmasters and all these, you know, are upset. And so you don't have to be a seaport city to be impacted maritimely, if there is such a word, by Jerusalem. She wasn't all that far from the coast to begin with. You know, they did have carts, and she did trade these commodities. They used Caesarea to do it. And then finally, coming down into verse 20 again, there's the pronouncement of judgment and the reason why. It's the saints and the apostles and prophets that are getting the judgment they wanted. So in 21, strong angel takes the stone like a millstone, throws it in the sea, and says, thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down violence and not be found any longer. Now, it's all these any longers that you see several times now in verses 21 and 22 that I just briefly, and 23, I guess, too, that I just briefly want to mention. Whether you're talking about Rome or you're talking about Jerusalem, did either city get vaporized and disappear and go into Superman's phantom zone? No. They're still there. There's still remnants there. There's still archaeological finds in both cities. There's still people living in both cities. The point either way is going to be that there's a giant and very focused short time destruction of the city. And then any longer, for some time to come, both, you know, cities were struggling. But Jerusalem, I think, much more so than Rome would could be described in this manner historically. It doesn't say eternally. It doesn't say absolutely. It's any longer just refers to, you know, some unspecified period of time where, you know, this trade is not going on. So 22, no harpists, musicians, etc. Light doesn't shine, all those things. But in verse 24, inevitably, we come back to the reason. And the reason will never fit Rome, brethren. It just doesn't. Now, in the last remaining minute or two, let me just give you some slides for you to consider. Artist renditions of the fall of Jerusalem. This one in particular, you know, I really like because it gives you a really excellent picture of the walls of the city, the towers that, you know, were so well fortified, the Roman army standing outside. You can see the dust of the wall as, you know, the catapults are hitting it and weakening it for its eventual destruction in this particular one. Now, this is a very famous picture here that, again, I think is really rather accurate just from the standpoint that it gives you an idea of the magnificence of Jerusalem at large, and then especially, you know, with the Temple Mount. It also gives you an idea of Josephus. So brethren, in this picture, really scaled back. He talks about hundreds and thousands of people falling off the walls, you know, in this city, and the blood just covering the pavement and flowing down the stairs, that people having to walk several bodies deep on top of the corpses, you know, to go somewhere. It was just unbelievably worse even than this artist suggests right here. Now, I know the bell rang, but just very quickly here. This is an actual sign in Jerusalem positioned at the southwest corner. You can see over here the rocks behind it and the rivets, you know, where it was tacked up. This is a sign you'll actually see when you're looking at the remains of the Temple Mount today at the southwest corner, and they're suggesting this is what it likely looked like, something like that. This square, I might go back and get it here, right there, the rectangle, is focusing on just this lower part right here where that arch begins. So I just wanted you to take note of that area right there on the sign. It's that area as you would look at the southwest corner today. This is the remnant of that arch, and it's how they then project
what it would have looked like and how the staircase came down, particularly since Josephus and others describe it as well. So that's the southwest corner of the temple. And please note, this graphic area right here is maybe 15 or 20 feet above the ground level of that corner of the temple. You have to walk, and I think it's right behind that rock right there. You go down a couple flights of steps, and you come down to that corner below, and you'll see that arch right there from the other side. The grass is over here. You come down the stairs, which you'll see in a minute, to get to the first century pavement. Those are the stones that Jesus and the apostles walked on, and these are the stones that the Romans cast off the Temple Mount, leaving only that foundation wall. They cast what was up on top down, and you can touch those stones, as I have, to this day. There's, again, now viewed from farther away at the other angle, that archway, what remains of it. No idea who this guy with the holy pants is, but he's standing on this rock right here. Now you can see that staircase you have to come down, where up above was where that grass was, looking at that corner over there. And then in this next shot, that stone would be way back in the back, right back there. He was standing on that stone, and the camera was looking this way. These are the first century paving stones. And what happens when you push rocks weighing several tons off that great height, 100 feet, and they hit the pavement below? What happens? It winds up getting all busted up like that. He was standing back there. I've been on those stairs and looked at this rubble from this southwest corner. Now then, that being said, what's this? The Arch of Titus, built by his brother Domitian about 82 A.D. to commemorate his brother who had died, his triumphs as emperor. As you go to Rome and you look at this arch, right there on the inside of the arch, there is a panel that has been carved. It's that one right there, which looks like this. That is that panel. What do you immediately notice about this? The menorah. Seven-branched lampstand that is in the temple. This is a commemoration of Titus' destruction of Jerusalem, one of the most famous monuments on all the earth depicting its fall. Here's a better view of it right here. What you have, the Roman standards, they had the legion numbers on that, they're carrying in triumph and victory, the articles from the temple, see the horns and whatnot, but all of this is just to say, we knocked down Jerusalem and were mighty proud of it. And we took down the temple, and what did they pick as their symbol of having destroyed that temple? That lampstand. Okay? Brethren, that was a big deal in the first century. Huge. Now, if that's just a podunk, not very important city, then why would you commemorate it like that? It was because it was hugely important in the Roman Empire. Enough that the merchants would weep while the kings were saying, look at me, because I've done something big. Okay? Thank you. Glasses.